Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
This morning's reading comes from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14, verses 1 to 11, and it can be found on page 1582 in your red pew Bibles if you're following on there. Now the Passover and the Festival of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were scheming to arrest Jesus secretly and kill him. But not during the festival, they said, or the people may riot. While he was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, made of pure nard. She broke the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Some of those present were saying indignantly to one another, "Why this waste of perfume? It could have been sold for more than a year's wages and the money given to the poor." And they rebuked her harshly. "Leave her alone," said Jesus. "Why are you bothering her? She has done a beautiful thing to me. The poor you will always have with you, and you can help them any time you want, but you will not always have me. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus to them. They were delighted to hear this and promised to give him money. So he watched for an opportunity to hand him over. This is the word of the Lord. Good morning, everyone. My name's Megan, if I haven't met you before. And if this is one of your first times here, then it is really special to have you. And youth being in, squeezed up on those couches, it is also great to have you with us this morning in big church. Well, what would you like written on your tombstone? Well, that's a hard pivot for 10 o'clock in the morning. I don't know, maybe you've walked through a country cemetery and you've looked at the headstones on graves. Maybe you've had to compose a memorial for a loved one. I don't know, maybe you're planning on watching the SBS series that Ray Martin is doing where he plans his own funeral. But you've thought to yourself, what would my epitaph say? Will it be heroic? Will it be solver of the climate crisis, feeder of the hungry, first woman on Mars? Will it be about your character? Will it be a loving dad, great friend, wise counsellor? Will it be about your achievements? Best-selling author, hilarious comic, brilliant preacher? Maybe you're hoping not to take things too seriously, like these people. On vacation, hold mail. I was hoping for a pyramid. Well, this sucks. And now I know something you don't. You got there in the end. Well done. Well, many of us do wonder about the legacy that we will leave. And that's a right and a good thing to think about. Maybe you're not always thinking about what's going to be on your tombstone, but maybe you're thinking, what would I like to be said about me at my 18th birthday party, 21st birthday party, 50th, 60th, 40th, 100th? Many years ago, I asked the Year 7 students at Ivanhoe Girls what they would like to have said about them in the speeches at their 21st. And they said things like, "I want to be known as a good friend, I want to be known as a good listener, that I'm fun to be around, that I'm kind." These are great things. So what about you? What memorial do you want to create from your life? This is a series called Stay Weird, and we're exploring what makes Christian believers, people who follow Jesus, stand out from the crowd. And so in our reading from Mark chapter 14 today, We got a very weird answer to the question of what makes a good memorial for one's life. Jesus himself gives that memorial for a woman who lived 2,000 years ago, who's unnamed, but her behaviour stood out so much, was so extraordinary, so radical, so weird, that it would cause Jesus himself to say these words, "Truly I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed or preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." That is some memorial. What she has done will be told in memory of her whenever the message about Jesus, the good news of our reconnection to God through him, is taught and shared and read and preached. She's going to be there. What she did was so extravagant, so worthy of remembering, that she will be remembered whenever the good news is proclaimed. It's big and it's weird. And so I want to ask us this morning, what was it about what she did that led to her receiving such an amazing memorial from Jesus? Well, it's dinner time in Bethany, and Jesus and his companions are sharing a meal in the home of a man named Simon the leper. Given he's hosting the meal, I think we can assume that Simon no longer had leprosy at this point. And given that they didn't have antibiotics, specifically, looked it up, clofazimine in the first century AD, I think we can assume that Simon was a recipient of healing by Jesus. Now, I don't know whether he still appreciated being called Simon the leper now that he didn't have leprosy, but I suspect he would have started to wear it as a badge of honour because he, amongst the believers, had experienced the power of Jesus firsthand. We know from the passage that Jesus and his disciples had been staying in Bethany for a number of days. By this point, they've decided to stay there as their base of operations to travel in and out of Jerusalem for the Passover. It's less than 4 kilometres, kind of like if you were travelling from interstate to come to the Australian Open and you decided we'll stay in South Yarra and we'll just kind of come in and out. Jesus was an honoured guest, and given Middle Eastern hospitality is so incredible, I think it's likely that Simon and his family had arranged a number of special meals to invite people to come and meet Jesus, and also to show their honour to him. So this evening, Simon and Jesus and some other people were reclining at the table. So they're leaning on elbows, on couches, or they're on cushions rather than sitting upright on chairs, when suddenly they're interrupted. A woman comes into the room, unbidden, probably in some state of emotion. She's not there to serve more food. She's not there to clear the plates. But she has a small alabaster jar in her hands. She heads to Jesus and she stands behind him. And before anybody knows what is happening, she's broken the jar and begins to anoint Jesus with its contents. Now, I couldn't have planned this better because the fragrance of the lunch is a little bit like what would have been interrupted by the overwhelming fragrance of this perfume. The dinner is on hold. What you've been enjoying suddenly is absolutely overwhelmed by this pungent aroma of nard. It's an oil from a root. All eyes are on the woman as she allows every last drop of the ointment to flow onto Jesus' head and probably down onto other parts. Now, I'm feeling kind of uncomfortable at this point. It seems like a very intimate and intense, pretty weird thing to do, to pour perfume on a man's head at a dinner party. But I've got to cross the cultural and time divide and see whether this is the weird thing that's going on. And Psalm 23, actually, is a great help. David writes about God, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows." This is actually welcomed behaviour. In the hot climate, in the much more rustic setting of the Middle East in the first century or earlier in David's time, this is not uncomfortable. It's not kind of weird and intimate and intense. It's VIP treatment. It's an expression of care and honour. It is hot towels. It is a guest room set aside for a traveller. It is the best moisturiser in the bathroom. It is kindness. It is honour. In Luke chapter 7, we probably get another retelling of this event. And Jesus actually comments on the fact that Simon didn't do these things himself. He says, "You did not give me water for my feet. You did not give me a kiss. You did not put oil on my head, but she did." So this is not strange behavior to a guest. This is an expression of honor, of care, of kindness. And because she did, in Mark's account, Jesus says, what she has done will be told in memory of her. What she has done sets her apart from the crowd. It's weird not because she put oil on a person's head, but actually it's weird because of, and we see this in the rest of the passage, it is extravagant and it is prophetic. That's why Jesus says it will be remembered and told. It's extravagant and it's prophetic. So extravagant. When we use the word extravagant, we do use it to mean excessive, exceeding the limits of reason, lacking in moderation, no balance, no restraint, extremely or excessively elaborate, spending much more than is necessary, profuse, lavish, even wasteful. And so in this setting, you can almost see the eyes of the dinner guests widen as they realize what it is that she's putting on his head. Pure nard, an expensive perfume. And Mark purposefully states that she didn't just open it, she broke it. This was not about using a little bit and then putting the cork back in and taking it home to use for the next guest or special person in your life. No, this is entirely used up, every last drop on Jesus. Very costly. And the cost is indeed great. And they comment on it. They say, this could have been sold for, and the text says 300 denarii, but in our NIV 2011, it says more than a year's wages. It does that interpretive work for us. So a labourer might have earned one denarius per day. So this is about a year's wages. So what we're talking about here is a jar of perfume that cost 60,000, 80,000, I don't know how much you earn, 200,000 per year, per jar. Now, I checked, and for the youth,
Good. This is the most expensive perfume at Mecca. And I don't know whether you like hanging around in Mecca, but I certainly find that if I try and go there, it's full of 12-year-olds. This perfume is the most expensive that is sold at Mecca Cosmetica. It's $2,000. I don't know if, exactly. I don't know any 12-year-olds that have got that, but maybe there are. So we're talking about, well, you do the maths, whatever, 40 bottles of this all at once on Jesus. This is how extravagant this action is. And it is absolutely astounding to the people. I wonder whether you feel comfortable being this extravagant. Not in terms of you need to give money to the church. I don't mean that. I mean giving so much of your life, pouring so much of yourself and everything that you have out for God, that people would be absolutely aghast. And for her, it's likely that this was a jar that had been handed down in the family. She didn't pick it up at Mecca. This is something that would have been a family heirloom, something that was greatly prized, sentimental, and she has used it on Jesus. Now, if you've been shaped by Australian culture, you will have been shaped to know that religious excess is frowned upon. The typical TV Anglican church is about the level that we can tolerate. Quiet, reserved, polite, contained to an hour and a half, if you're unlucky. On a Sunday, the vicar is kind of quiet, bumbling, kind, academic, small talk over morning tea, the occasional lunch, hymns that are familiar but not too emotional, or a choir singing the most beautiful classical music that you can enjoy. Now, maybe we could add to that the Salvation Army in their charity arm. That's pretty tolerable. The restraint of the Anglicans and the charitable practical works of the Salvation Army, not their worship, not their churches, just the bits with the helping the people and the providing safe and secure housing and that's about as good as we get. But here we have a woman who is told that her memory will be spoken of every time the gospel is preached because she is so extravagant. She has poured out everything for Jesus. Why this waste of perfume, people say? Why this extravagance? These are people who are with Jesus. They weren't shaped by Australian culture, and yet here they are. And they rebuked her harshly. So what about those of us who are told or who long to spend time worshiping God? Singing, praising, praying for others, reading our Bibles that not just to prepare a Bible study or a sermon or, you know, something, a devotion for school or whatever it is, but actually just because we want to hear from God. We want to spend time in His presence. When we had those amazing video testimonies and Michael shared his story, the thing that Phil and I were really encouraged and challenged by was the language that Michael used. I didn't tell him I was going to do this, but I'm being nice. Of the idol of achievement. Maybe you didn't say it exactly like that, but you used the words achievement. What am I going to do with my life? What am I going to achieve? And I think it was one of the first times where I'd added that language into my understanding of what it could mean to be dragged away from the extravagance that God calls me to as I give my life to Him. Achievement, you know, like I've always spoken about, oh, don't go after money and do as I say, not as I dress. But achievement, if you don't achieve something in life, if what you're doing is not practical or reasonable or sensible or productive, then it's a waste, it's extravagant. And so this woman has achieved nothing with this year's wages worth of perfume. Nothing. Except to glorify Jesus. Except to pour out her love upon Him. Now, Jesus is not denying the value of giving to the poor. Of course not. That was part of the commandments of God. At the time of festivals like the Passover, it was even more common practice to show the poor special kindness, like our Royal Children's Hospital Easter Good Friday appeal, or our giving trees, like in Kmart and the Smith family at Christmas. But Jesus wants people to know that the second great commandment, love your neighbour as yourself, is not the way entirely to fulfil the first commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Jesus has no problem being worshipped in a way that seems unreasonable, excessive, extravagant, even wasteful. The people who wanted the poor to be fed with this money had missed the call of God to be utterly devoted beyond reason, beyond sensible, beyond practical. Jesus means for us to let the beauty of who He is and what He has done move us to extravagance in our time, in our emotion, in our praise, in word and song and writing and prayer, in what we do with our money and how we raise our kids, in how we do community and friendship and compassion, extravagance, unreasonable excess, wastefulness for the sake of Jesus. Now, even though we don't have her name in Mark's gospel, this woman is probably Mary of Bethany. They're in that town. And we see in other places that she was interacting at this time and in the house of Simon. Mary of Bethany is the sister of Martha, to whom Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." And the sister of Lazarus, who was raised from the dead by Jesus. This is the Mary who sat at the feet of Jesus, drinking in His teaching. She knew the depth of His wisdom and the heights of His power, death-raising power. She knew his compassion. She'd seen his tears. She, of all people in that room, realized that Jesus is who Mark says he is at the beginning of the gospel, the Messiah, the Son of God. Some of us have been looking at John chapter 4 in the ripple effect studies in our growth groups. And every time I've read this part about Jesus seeking worshippers who will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, I think I've applied it to church. I think I've said, well, isn't this good? We're a church that has some emotion about it, but also has some strong teaching. This is about balance. Jesus wants us to worship him with our heads as well as our hearts. But when I come to Mary of Bethany, I wonder if we see a different picture of what it means to worship Jesus, to respond to Jesus in truth. She has seen who Jesus is. There is truth about Jesus in her life which wells up in worship. She's listened to him. She's been around him. She's spent time with him. She's seen his marvelous deeds. She's felt his love. She knows the truth of who Jesus is, and so she worships. I can just imagine her meditating on these things, the truth of what she's experienced in her life and what she's known about Jesus and heard him teach. And she's maybe hanging around the back of the house. Maybe she's helping out. Maybe she's just in the neighborhood. Maybe she was kind of one of the guests, but she's slipped out because she can't help herself. Runs home, gets the family heirloom, and comes back to anoint the most incredible person she's ever met. The truth about him and her engagement with him throughout his ministry means that it's not unreasonable to her. The only reasonable response to Jesus is to be excessive, extravagant, wasteful in her devotion. And that is worship in spirit and in truth. Jesus commends her for it, not just because of its extravagance, but also because of its prophetic meaning. Actually didn't even think about the way in which we've done so much work on sign acts for prophets before coming to this passage. But in Jeremiah, we've seen the prophet do things and enact things that tell people about who God is and what he wants for them. And Jesus looks at what this woman has done, and he says, this is what she's doing. This is actually a sign act. She did what she could. She poured perfume on my body beforehand to prepare for my burial. Now, she didn't actually have that necessarily in her mind. But Jesus says, because she is one who is sold out, who is just responding to me in truth, this action that she has done, this worship, this excessive, unreasonable gift, actually turns out to tell people who I am and what is coming. Now, we know from this passage what is coming because this is the time of the Passover. We've seen it at the start of this passage, start of the chapter. We know that the leaders are looking for a way to kill Jesus, but they said, oh, we better not do it during the festival because the people will riot. We know at the end of this passage, Judas goes off and says, oh, I've got a way. We can get rid of this one who claims so much devotion for himself. And so this woman's actions become a prophecy of what is to come. Not just anointing the anointed king, but also anointing the suffering servant, the one whose gift to the world would not simply be in his teaching and presence and compassion and tears and power, but in his death. If you remember, after the death of Jesus, the women don't get a chance to anoint his body for burial. So when the women go on the very early, on the first day of the week, they're bringing the things to anoint his body, because it is the Sabbath when he was buried and they weren't able to do it then. And do they find the body? They do not. This is that anointing, Jesus says. This is the thing that ought to be done for me, because I am going to die for the sins of the world. And then, of course, the contrast. It can't be done after he died, because he is risen. Being extravagant will be prophetic. Being extravagant in our worship will point to who Jesus is, will point to the reality of the world, will point to how people should live. Not just being good and kind to other people. Absolutely the right thing to do. But have a look at this passage from Acts chapter 2. The believers were together, had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Absolutely. But every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. Excess in caring for people, absolutely. But excess in devotion to God, in praising him, in speaking out how good he is, in spending time together with his people, lifting him up. And they enjoyed the favor of all the people, and the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. In the book of Hebrews, it tells us that this sort of prophetic action, being excessive and extravagant in what we're willing to express to God and the amount of time and what we prioritize, and being willing to look like fools as we worship God, as we speak his name in public, actually tells people what heavenly realities are like. You have come to Mount Zion. This is you coming to the new kingdom, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. Worship is God's due, and he desires it. It is the reality of where he dwells, and we join in with it when we are extravagant and excessive. Thousands upon thousands of angels worship God always. And so he concludes, the writer to the Hebrews, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. When we, like Mary of Bethany or this unnamed woman, are willing to be extravagant, excessive, unreasonable, impractical in our time, our love, our devotion to Jesus, we actually show the world that God is worthy. God is the King. God is a consuming fire. God must be worshipped with reverence and awe, with great abandon, and with great extravagant love. I've asked Chantel and Nick to bring a musical item for us as we conclude this message, and then I'll come back up and pray for us. This song, I wanted us to have something where we didn't just move straight into us singing, because I don't want you to think I'm telling you have to do more singing, although that could be. And I'm certainly not saying we should have longer sermons and that's how it is. What I'm saying is God's calling you to be abandoned to be excessive and extravagant in your love for him. And if you're not finding that possible, then you need to get back to the truth of who he is.